prongs. Karunta strode before them, grinning like a glutton locked in a bakery.
"Now you will experience a true run to the top of the fells. Biting heavy armour and splinters on the hands. Lovely."
More groans and disbelieving whimpers. Then he smirked at Hattu.
"And then you can enjoy a nice refreshing cup of water when you're up there."
The ascent to the top of the fells was every bit as painful as Karunta had predicted. The armour chewed at their skin and trapped the heat of the day against their bodies. Once up there, they were given but a moment to catch their breaths before combat training began. First, they took to running an obstacle course, leaping over rocks, ducking and rolling under raised logs and dodging around poles, all with their armour and weapons anchoring them. After that, they mock-battled, now clashing bronze weapons instead of wooden poles. Hattu and Dagon partnered up to spar. The spears were heavier with the additional weight of the bronze tip and tang, and they found that keeping the weapon level was hard enough, let alone manoeuvring it into a position where they might strike. Next, they fought with swords. These were light as air in comparison, and the blades clashed over and over as they and the many other pairs of boys fought to tap the flat of their blade against their opponent's chest, scoring a kill.
"Balance! Balance!"
Karunta screamed, striding amongst the sparring lads with his hands clasped behind his back.
"You can have all the strength in the world, but if you have the spryness of a pregnant elephant, your head will end up as an ornament in a Cascan mudhouse."
Hattu felt Karunta's eye on him more than once. As much as he loathed the general, his only means of hurting the man was to defy him. And so he marked Dagon with a kill, then Garin too, then Sargis. At noon, only 10 boys were left fighting and not yet killed.
"Meh,"
Karunta grumbled, and shrugged as he eyed the remaining boys. It wasn't quite the praise many had hoped for. In the noon heat, he then split them into two parties, one patrolling a rocky outcrop that rose like a skywards pointing finger, the other tasked with outmaneuvering the patrolling lot and claiming the finger for themselves. Karunta climbed up the finger and sat upon it like a vulture, watching it all. Hattu was in Tanku's patrolling 50, with Dagon and Garin. It was just like the exercise they had witnessed between the Blaze and the Rothmen on their first day up on the hills, he realized. They shot glances to the rocky finger, then all around. The other 50 remained unseen, so they moved in a tight circle, round and round the finger. The ground nearby was pitted and uneven, and each of them remembered well how the Blaze soldiers had hidden in such a crater before stealing up on the Rothmen's flank. Under the full sun, they were tiring fast. "They'll never come at us while we move like this," Hattu said to Dagon. "Wherever they're hiding, they'll just wait it out. They're in the shade, and we're not. When we slow and tire, then they'll have us." Dagon nodded slowly. Hattu flicked a finger to the wide, shallow natural trench in the earth that led right up to the rocky finger. A pile of rocks lay at the near end of it. "That's the easiest approach. The other 50 will come for the rocky finger that way. On the next circuit, we'll pass unseen by those rocks. We should fall in behind them, wait in the shade. Turn this exercise on its head."
"Tell Tanku,"
Dagon said. Hattu's lips shifted to one side.
"Anything I say to him, he'll reject out of hand."
Dagon smiled wryly, winked at Hattu, then jogged forward to mutter in Tanku's ear. The big recruit's eyes moved this way and that, as if piecing together the idea in his own mind. Then he turned round and whispered to the others.
"On the next pass, we stop by the rocks, aye?"
"Aye,"
the rest said in a hushed agreement. Dagon fell back to Hattu's side, grinning. They fell into the shady lee of the rocks. Their parched breaths subsided, and then there was a silence. Hattu felt a terrible doubt grip him. What if the other 50 spotted the trap and stole up on the rocky finger from the other side? But then, crunch, crunch, crunch. He edged his head from the shade of the rock pile, seeing the shadows of approaching, scuttling men. Tanku saw it too and held up a finger, then swished it down. The 50 burst from the shade by the rocks and fell upon their startled opponents. Weapons clacked on shields and curses mixed with laughter.
"Victory,"
Hattu mouthed, eager to share the momentary elation with his team. But he felt a molten gaze on his neck and turned, Seeing Carunta glaring down upon him, his silvery braid dancing in the weak breeze atop the rocky finger.
The shade by the rocks. That was Hattu's plan,
Dagon panted as the clamour subsided. Hattu swung round, seeing Tanku's face fall. The big recruit shrugged.
Aye, well, good for him. Best he finished this early, so he might just have enough energy to bring us our water,
he said without a trace of humour. Carunta half-climbed down the rocky finger, then leapt down onto the hilltop with a dusty thud.
Indeed, thirsty work, that. Prince Hattusili, if you would.
He gestured from the edge of the hilltop down to the wagon with the water pole. Grunts of dismay sounded from the recruits. They knew what would happen now. Hattu eyed them all for a moment. The image of the dauntless ant played over and over in his mind. He glanced past the gathered recruits, seeing the now complete ant's nest a little way behind them.
No task is impossible, as you have shown me, little friend, he thought.
Are you waiting a litter and some slaves to carry you down there, eh?
Carunta snapped. Hattu carefully set down his spear, shield, helm and sword. He started to untie his armour when Carunta added,
Keep the cuirass on,
unless it's too much for you.
Hattu bit his lip and refastened the leather straps, then turned away to jog down the dusty slope.
One-eyed bastard,
he growled inwardly as he stumbled down the fells. He kept his footing thanks to his now rope-like hamstrings and bronze-hard quadriceps, and managed to stand tall as he reached the bottom and strode over to the usual two sneering soldiers who had the water pole ready for him. The pole was loaded onto his shoulders with three buckets at either end.
Off you go,
one of the soldiers said with a lazy chuckle. Hattu turned away from them. Up he went, feeling the weighty pole and its six buckets crush down upon his shoulders and steal his breath, trample his spirits. Then he looked up, seeing the baleful looks of the hill pups.
Today they will drink.
Just over halfway up, his feet began to sink deeply into the dust. Then he stopped, dipping to his knees. The recruits groaned. Tanku spat on the ground and turned away, cursing. Hattu looked up, sweat running across his face. He stepped out of the yoke pole, lifted one bucket off, and poured it into the dust. Then he did the same with the others.
What in the name of Halki's arse are you doing?
Carunta howled.
Start again!
Hattu fixed his gaze on his one-eyed tormentor and calmly lifted the yoke pole and six empty buckets back onto his shoulders, then climbed with ease, up, up, and onto the hilltop.
Did you hear me?
Carunta screamed in his ear.
I heard you on that first day, Hattu replied calmly. You challenged me to bring water to my comrades.
Aye, water, not empty buckets,
Carunta roared. Hattu walked past him and stopped by a flat, wide rock on the ground, stooping to rummage in the brush at one side of it. Standing again, holding a spade and a length of rope concealed there, he met every pair of eyes.
Today you will drink, he said flatly.
He dug the spade under the rock and planted a booted foot on its bronze shoulder. Levering hard, the rock lifted, and with a twist, he shifted it to one side. Now the watching eyes grew wide, drawn to the dark hole under the rock. Hattu took one of the empty buckets from the yoke pole and tied the rope to its handle, then lowered it down. As he did so, he thought of every night, every moment of back-breaking digging. He thought of the uncertainty. The cool, moist earth he had found in the ant's furrow suggested water might lie underneath, as Ruba had taught him, but there was no guarantee. A month of doubts and toil. Then last night, he had struck water. A splash sounded some way below, scattering his thoughts, bringing him back to the searing hot day. He drew the bucket back up, brimming with water from an underground vein of the soldier's spring, untied it and walked past Carunta. He heard the one-eyed general grumble,
You dirty, devious hurkler,
as he calmly handed the bucket to Garin, the nearest of the hill pups, then turned back to the well.
I will stop if you wish me to, sir,
he said to Carunta. But I have completed your orders. The objective was to bring water to the men, wasn't it? One ascent? Six buckets? Carunta growled like an angered cat and flicked his head towards the well. Hattu drew another few buckets and handed them round. then sat near the rest as they drank. He asked for no water for himself. When Dagon handed him a cupful, Hattu noticed the cold eyes of the others upon him, Tanku's in particular.
"Drink it,"
Tanku said, looking off past Hattu towards Karunta, now standing with his back turned, too far away to hear, he hoped.
"Before Karunta drowns you in it."
A dull rumble of callous laughter broke out at this.
"And if he doesn't drown me, then I fully expect a turd on a plate for my evening meal tonight,"
Hattu said. Tanku snorted once in dry humour at this, and the others laughed too, guardedly.
"Water,"
Dagon said, lashing a cup over his dusty skin.
"Tomorrow and every other day we have water while we're up here. Is that not a fine thing?"
The others murmured in relieved agreement. But Karunta cut it short, swinging back to face them all.
"Tomorrow?"
"No,"
he said, eyeing Hattu askance.
"Tomorrow we try something different."
That evening, with the rudimentary well complete and the water ordeal broken, Hattu considered rewarding himself with a long, uninterrupted sleep. But as darkness had fallen, the whispers in his mind began to fight fiercely against his sense of achievement.
"Cursed son,"
they shrieked, enraged that he had dared to defy them. And so the notion of a night scramble, the only place the whispers could not be heard, came to him. As soon as the others were asleep, he rose and sped up the red hillside under a waning moon, crickets singing and a lone owl hooting. He found a dusty crag up there and scaled it, reaching the top and taking a moment to gaze up at the stars, to spot the constellations and to catch his breath before setting off back for the infantry compound again. When he returned to the barrack house, he slowed, seeing a lone figure standing by the door. Tanku, Hattu realized. He approached cautiously, hoping Tanku would go back inside before he reached the door, but the big burly lad was not for moving. Hattu considered waiting out of sight, but when his heel ground on a patch of dirt, Tanku swung round like a sentry on duty. His eyes were like moons, his face tight with terror. When he saw Hattu, his demeanor darkened.
"You?"
he said waspishly.
"Aye, me,"
Hattu said, edging past the big lad. Tanku caught his arm.
"That water, well, was a pleasant surprise.
And the sortie, too. I suppose I owe you gratitude of some sort for that."
Hattu nodded awkwardly.
"You should sleep, you know," he said. "You will need your energy for tomorrow, for whatever Karunta has planned for us."
Tanku shrugged.
"I don't need to sleep."
To Hattu, the words rang distinctly untrue, and the black rings under Tanku's eyes supported this theory. He saw how the big recruit's gaze kept darting into the shadows of the barrack room, to his deserted bed a few strides inside. Confused, Hattu peered there also. No, the bed wasn't deserted. In it was a small, dark, eight-legged shape. When the spider scurried suddenly, Tanku snatched in a breath, almost leaping back from the doorway as if the tiny creature could spring at him from there. An intense urge to laugh grew in Hattu's belly. The burly, fearless Tanku, the champion recruit, destined to lead men one day, was afraid of spiders. He checked the laugh, seeing the raw terror in the big lad's eyes. Silently, he stepped inside, plucked the spider from the bed, and tossed it outside through one of the shutters, big Tanku peering inside to watch like a nervous child.
"Until morning,"
he said quietly to Tanku, before stepping over to his own bed and turning in. Karunta roused the hill pups before dawn. Hattu awoke from a deep, thick sleep to find the general shaking him violently with a dog snarl on his features.
"Time to rise, priest,"
he hissed. With a few coughs, pained emissions of wind, bewildered groans and muted words of confusion, they shuffled from the academy grounds in the cool darkness in their armour and carrying their weapons, following Karunta to the south. They crossed over the broad track that linked Hattusa with the eastern and western extremes of Hittite lands. As dawn broke like a golden hawk, spreading its fiery wings across the sky, they climbed a long, slow path up a grey-green mountainside to the tune of the rising cicada song.
"Keep moving, Herclus,"
Karunta grunted.
"You'll just love what I have in store for you today."
Hattu glanced at Dagon, who shot back an equally bemused look. The ascent steepened sharply, and a distinctly cool breeze swirled around them. Suddenly a flurry of gasps rang out. Hattu looked ahead, craning his neck like the others. The slope levelled out onto a plateau of sorts, about halfway up the mountainside. Up there, glaring somberly down upon them, was an ancient stone huasi, far taller than the warrior statues back at the academy grounds. This was a towering effigy of a man sculpted from storm-grey limestone, veined with white. Bearded, he wore a tall conical helm and braved the cutting winds, bare-chested, with just a scaled kilt covering his waist and thighs. His feet were apart as if marching, right arm raised with the fist clenched in salute. The grass up there was bent almost flat, and they could hear the forlorn moan of the wind passing around the statue.
"Saruma, the mountain god,"
Hattu whispered, almost in time with the many other recruits, his hair blowing across his face as he beheld the effigy, worn smooth in places by centuries of wind, snow, and rain. It had probably been erected by the earliest kings of Hattusa, Hattu guessed. They slowed behind Karunta as they arrived by the foot of the Huasi, the wind buffeting them. By the statue's base there were shards of clay vessels, age-old libations of beer made to the mountain god. Wordlessly, the recruits took to unhooking the small leather bags tied near the tips of their spears and breaking pieces from their bread ration, laying it by the deity's feet. Hattu made his offering, then looked behind the statue. A few paces beyond, the plateau was riven in two by a wide, jagged fissure. A rocky spur jutted out like an arm, stretching partway across this ravine. Its surface was almost flat and smooth, well polished by rains. On the far side of the ravine lay a shorter, stumpier arm, pointing back. But a gap existed between the two tips, as wide as a tall man lying prone, arms outstretched, he reckoned. He approached the ravine edge and heard a tumultuous roar of rushing water. He stretched his neck to glance over the edge, seeing the knots of white water and clouds of foam and spray down there, so far below that it made him dizzy. Jutting from the furious water were black fangs of rock, worn smooth like wetted blades. Hittite lore told that every stream, pond, river, and lake marked the edge of one of the many passages to the underworld, the dark earth. And right here and now, Hattu understood why.
"Be careful, Prince!"
Karunta yelled, slapping his hands onto Hattu's shoulders from behind. Hattu wailed, eliciting a chorus of mocking laughter from the others. He drew back, skin prickling with the ebbing fright and rising humiliation, while Karunta strode up to stand on the neck of the near spur and turned to face the recruits.
"This was once a natural bridge, so the elders said, part of a path that led to the good tracts of shallow pasture in these low mountains, ideal for grazing horses and cattle in the arid summer months. Now the bridge is broken, no use to herdsmen. Soldiers, on the other hand."
"A recruit will jump, and a soldier will land on the other side,"
Dagon whispered by Hattu's side.
"My father told me about this. I didn't believe him."
"Ah, our first volunteer,"
Karunta said, his face brightening. Dagon emitted a syllable that suggested he wasn't so keen. But a chant struck up, gleefully orchestrated by Karunta, and the recruits quickly formed the walls of a makeshift corridor, leading to the near side spur of the broken bridge. Dagon gulped.
"You're strong enough," Hattu whispered. "The gap is wide, but not so wide. I know you can do it."
Dagon gulped again and flashed a timid look of thanks to Hattu, then set down his shield and weapons, unbuckled his linen vest and prized off his boots so he wore just his loincloth. As the chanting grew more rapid, Dagon crouched, his right leg slightly proud, then sprang forward. He raced out onto the rocky spur and leapt. Hattu's stomach clenched. The chanting faded. Silence, but for the moaning wind. Dagon flailed through the air, legs cycling as he went. Thud! He landed on the far spur with a stride to spare, then staggered onto the safe ground on the other side, turning round, eyes wide, mouth agape. A reticent cheer rose up from the recruits, each more concerned about their turn. Hattu offered him a swift, clenched fist salute, while Kistner tossed Dagon's arms and armor over to him. Next went Big Tanku. He stripped down to his loincloth and began by stretching his legs, bending his well-toned torso one way then the other, eyes fixed all the time on the broken bridge. There was an air of utter confidence about this lad, a sparkle in his eyes that suggested he already knew he would have no trouble making the leap. A stark contrast to his boy-like fear of the spider the previous night, Hattu thought. The chanting grew again, as Tanku crouched like a lion about to spring, then launched himself forward, building into a ferocious sprint, stride lengthening as he struck out onto the jagged spur. The chanting faded again, as 100 breaths were sucked in at once, and Tanku's ham-like thigh muscles tensed, every sinew stretching and spending the momentum of the sprint as he leapt high and fast, legs astride, then tucked his calves up behind his thighs, arms aloft as if to cut through the wind. Thud. He landed soundly, with 3 strides to spare, his legs uncoiling so his feet met the stony spur on the far side at a jog. Turning, he swept his eyes over everyone on the other side of the ravine, his hair billowing across his face. He took to beating 1 fist against his breast, then punched the air and let out a wolf-like howl. Those watching on the other side erupted in a chorus of cheers. The recruits lined up one after the other, each facing their own fear and leaping out across the void, the dread morphing into elation as each landed safely. Tanku's wolf howl caught on too, each emitting their own version. Gradually, the corridor of recruits on this near side shrank until there were only a handful left. Hattu felt his heart beat faster and his limbs shudder. Best to go now than to be last, he reasoned. But as he put forward towards the run-up, Karunta blocked him with a hand.
Not yet, he growled. For a prince, it must be different. You must show that no level of fear will stand in your way.
He was unfurling a square of black cloth from his belt as he said this. Sargis Kisner, then Garin, went next in his stead. The chant struck up as Garin knotted his long black hair into a tight tail. The plump recruit had lost weight since his enlistment, but he was still ungainly in his stride and carried more bulk than he ought to. Hattu thought of his night scrambles and knew that being lean and spry offered a huge advantage, but timing and judgment were equally important.
Measure your stride, Hattu said quietly to Garin as the boy prepared himself. Get as close to the edge of the spur as you can before you jump.
Garin shot him an irritable, nervous look.
Oh, I don't need your advice, he murmured.
Hattu shrugged and backed away. Garin surged forward, his feet pounding onto the spur. His toes met the end of it, and he launched himself. A perfect stride, Hattu thought. But Garin's leap was poor, with little elevation. The held breath this time turned into a cacophonous series of alarmed cries. Thud! Garin landed, belly first, just on the edge of the far spur, his legs thrashing over the void. The cries faded to a chorus of relieved laughter as Garin scrambled like a spider to safety. Now just Karunta and Hattu stood on the near side. Hattu turned to Karunta.
Now can I jump?
By way of reply, a sudden stark crack rang out. All heads shot to the edge of the far spur where Garin had landed heavily. A section of shale, about the width of a man, broke away from it and tumbled into the abyss. Silence. Then a splash, where some of the loosened material had met with the angry waterway far below.
The jump is wider,
one boy shouted across from the far side with a tremor in his voice. The words sent a cold fear over Hattu. Karunta turned his head to glare at Hattu, his lips peeling back in a foul-toothed smile.
You want to take your turn?
Certainly,
he said triumphantly. Just as Hattu began to stretch his legs, Karunta held up the square of black cloth and walked behind Hattu, wrapping it over his eyes and tying it behind his head.
Sir?
Hattu said, eyes switching to and fro in the sudden blackness.
Now watch, Hillpups, as your prince demonstrates his superior courage,
Karunta boomed, ignoring Hattu.
He can jump higher and further than any of you, and he can do it with his eyes closed.
A refrain of derisive mutters sounded.
You expect me to jump when I can't even see,
he said, as Karunta oriented him towards the spur.
Afraid, Prince, Karunta cooed.
Hattu felt the wind turn cold as winter. His legs felt like water, and even the thought of the ravine's unseen proximity made him feel sick and dizzy. His breathing grew ragged and short, and a stinging panic rose from his belly to his breast, then coiled around his throat as if to choke him. All the fears of falling that had plagued his climbs came to him at once like a multi-headed demon.
"I will understand if you'd prefer not to make the jump,"
Kurunta continued, resting his hands on Hattu's shoulders.
"Just ask me to send you back to Hattusa tonight, and you need not do it. You can take off the blindfold and set yourself at ease. No more danger, no more fear."
In his mind's eye, he saw that which the cloth blocked out, the void and the spurs. But there were just two people there, the shadowy, green-cloaked warrior across the jump, and the round-shouldered scribe here, beside him. A fiery defiance overcame him.
"Curse you, sir,"
he said through clenched teeth, shrugging Karunta's hands from his shoulders, then setting off for the spur like a deer. He heard a gasp of shock from the gnarled general, but pounded onwards. He had watched all the other boys, noticed their speeds, counted their strides. 5 strides took him onto the spur. Then he felt the surface underfoot change, soft, smooth. Another 3 strides to the precipice. The ball and toes of his right foot met the rugged edge of the spur perfectly. Then he leapt. Soaring, he heard only the roar of the wind. It seemed too long, endless. Had he missed the far spur? And was he right now plummeting towards the black rocky fangs below? Wretched terror shook him, only to be swept away by a bone-rattling crunch as he slammed down onto the end of the far spur, then rolled over and onto the safe, flat ground. He stood up and tore the blindfold off, tossing it into the ravine, shooting a fiery glare back at a gawping Kurunta, then eyeing each of the recruits likewise. There was no round of cheers, no wolf howls. Just a stunned silence.
"I jumped not to prove that I am stronger, faster, or more courageous than any of you. I jumped because I want to be one of you. No more."
A few grumbled in disagreement. Some were still stunned. Tanku gave him a grey look, but said nothing. Kurunta leapt across like a springing cat, landing beside Hattu, and for a moment looking like he was about to brain him. Instead, he spat on the ground.
"You jumped," he said, shaking his head. "You actually jumped."
"You were certain I wouldn't,"
Hattu replied. Kurunta beheld him for a moment longer.
"You remind me of me when I was young. I was stupid too,"
he scoffed, then jogged past the recruits, leading them on uphill.
"He's running out of ideas,"
Dagon whispered to Hattu as they went, a wry eye on Kurunta. They came to a mountain brook, gurgling and narrow. Kurunta halted there, shooting an exasperated eye across the hill pups.
"So, who knows of the river ordeal?"
he said. The 100 young soldiers gulped, each sure that whatever it was, it would be unpleasant. Moments later, they were in the white cold waters in only their loincloths, neck deep. Hattu sat beside Dagon. Both boys with their arms clutched around themselves, shivering, teeth chattering, lips blue. The cold was insufferable, penetrating to their bones, frosting their marrow, clouding their minds. Kurunta, striding around them on the banks, seemed utterly unmoved. Garin rummaged underwater with one hand, then fell aghast.
I can't feel it, he stammered. It's disappeared inside me.
It was never that big anyway,
Kurunta remarked calmly, before covering one nostril and blowing a blob of rubbery filth from the other.
"So remember, the first to leave guarantees half rations for the lot of you tonight,"
he reiterated.
"The choice is yours, blue balls or empty stomachs."
"This is nonsense,"
Tanku contested.
"One of us must leave first, so the punishment is guaranteed."
Kurunta strode round the edge of the brook to crouch by the burly recruit.
"This is nonsense, sir,"
he corrected.
"And you are right. You will be eating half rations tonight regardless. The test is to see who will break first, choosing to end their own suffering at the cost of their comrades' well-being."
Hattu caught Tanku's eye. The big recruit was as blue as the rest of them, and for a blessed moment the pair were in accord.
If we all rise at once, then the suffering ends and no one person has to take the blame.
Tanku's teeth stopped chattering for a moment.
But damn, you're right.
He rose a little, waded into the center of the group, and waved his hands up.
Up! Get up! If we all get out at once!
He repeated Hattu's words. There was a moment of uncertainty. Then the 100 rose onto their feet, made a careful few steps to the brook's edge, and stepped out more or less together. Karunta said nothing. His withering gaze was enough.
Get your clothes on, and be ready to march.
They filed down the mountain again, retracing their steps. When they came to the broken bridge of the mountain god, it had lost something of its aura. Broken as a bridge, broken as a challenge. The boys leapt across one by one, giving fresh wolf howls as they landed. Hattu, blindfold free, relished the leap this time, then turned to watch Tanku, last to make the jump. The big recruit's confident demeanor was as striking as the first time, his long legs eating up the run-up and the ball of his foot coming down perfectly on the edge of the far spur. Then the mountainside echoed with a thick, stark crack. Tanku's face fell, just like the end of the far spur, the section under his kicking foot snapping off under his weight just as he launched himself. The shard plummeted into the void. Tanku shot across the gap, flailing, his face widening into a cry of horror as he fell short and disappeared into the abyss.
Gods!
Karunta cried, lumbering over to the edge of the ravine, staring down. The 100 sped to look over the edge too, some kneeling, some on all fours. Hattu felt a cold sense of horror for the boy's end. An enemy, but a decent lad behind it all, he reckoned. Then he heard a weak cry.
I can't hold on!
Hattu stretched his neck out a little further, then saw it. Tanku, clinging by his forearms to a glistening, wet wart of rock poking from the ravine side, the height of 2 men below the edge. His wrists and elbows were bleeding, and the rest of his body dangled over the gnashing rocky fangs and thrashing waters.
Spear!
Karunta demanded, snatching the first lance offered. He slashed the tip of the spear off with one of his swords, then fell prone at the ravine edge, holding the shaft down.
Grab it!
He called down. Tanku stretched one hand up, but the end of the spear fell short of his reach. The momentary effort caused his other forearm to slip, and he was nearly gone, were it not for his sudden grabbing of the wart of rock with just his palms.
Rope!
Karunta called over his shoulder, face red like an angry crab, eyes bulging. No reply. Hattu knew Tanku was as good as dead, but already he had mapped out the slight indents and creases on the ravine side. He pulled off his boots, helm, and vest, and slid his legs over the side, clinging to the edge, feet searching for the first hold.
Hattu, what in the name of Tahunda's crotch are you doing? The rock is wet. Get back up here,
Karunta croaked, still trying in vain to stretch a little further down with the spear pole. Hattu's foot found the hold. He shifted one hand to a slight ledge, then stretched his other foot down. Another lip of rock, wet as a fish, and he went lower. It was just like that black day when he and Sarpa had been climbing. Over brave, he had scaled along a wet section of bluff like this. He had nearly died for it, and poor Sarpa's hip had been shattered, saving him.
Give me the strength for this, Sarpa, he muttered inwardly.
Within a few moments, he heard Tanku's pained breaths. He scaled down until he was directly over the burly recruit, then halted, checking his grip was good. It was not. The stone slimy and smooth where the water had worn it away and the hold shallow. But it would have to do.
Climb, he panted down at Tanku. Use my leg like a post. Climb up.
Tanku's face was wrinkled in terror, now only his fingertips holding him from doom, but even they were slipping. Hattu recognized the look. Fear. A land where all the senses blurred and nothing made sense.
Tanku!
He yelled. This seemed to snap the boy from his trance. The big lad stretched up, clamped a hand to Hattu's shin, then hauled himself up until he had a hold of Hattu's shoulders.
Hurry!
Hattu strained, feeling his fingers slipping in the slimy holds.
All the gods be with you!
Tanku panted, as he clambered on over Hattu to grab Karunta's spear and scale to safety.
Take the spear!
Kurunta roared, louder than a thunderstorm. Hattu looked up to see the puce-faced general thrusting the spear end at him now. He sucked in a few deep breaths, then rose to the next pock-shallow hold before clasping the wooden shaft and clambering up. It all happened in moments, and then he found himself being hauled to safety, falling onto his back on the plateau, the sound of the 100 recruits cheering and whooping, threaded with guttural, blistering curses from Kurunta. A hand clasped Hattu's, bringing him to his feet, then raising his arm in the air. Hattu realized it was Tanku, who emitted a piercing wolf howl, gesturing for the others to do the same. Hattu felt the ground shiver under him, such was their din. He saw the eyes of his detractors, different now, glinting with esteem. He realized a smile was creeping across his face. A moment later, and he joined them, turned his face to the sky, wet hair draping between his shoulders, and howled with all the air left in his lungs. Unbroken by the river ordeal, undaunted by the red fells or this mountain bridge, Tanku panted. We are soldiers now, he yelled in delight. Kurunta's curses only became fierier now.
I'll tell you when you're a company of soldiers. You're the hill pups, and the hill pups you'll remain.
Dagon lifted Hattu's other hand, howling too. Hattu opened his mouth, hesitating for a moment when he saw Karunta's lobster-pink features shaking with rage, then carrying on regardless.
We are the Mountain Wolves!
He cried out joyously. Some days later, Kurunta was stricken with some gut illness that saw him confined to the latrine pits. All within the Fields of Bronze could hear his ox-like oaths that came with every gastric expulsion, and any who dared look the crouching general in the eye when they went to the pits themselves, if they could brave the foul stench, was threatened with dismemberment. So, for a blessed few days, the Mountain Wolves were assigned to archery training instead, on the broad ranges near the foot of the Red Fells, under the auspices of the kneeling archer statue. The cool, shady air of the Fletcher's workshop was pleasant on Hattu's skin, and alive with flecks of sawdust floating in the golden curtain of sunlight from the roof hatch above. New unstrung composite bows of horn and wood hung in high racks, confined there for the long year it would take for them to fully dry and bind. The pleasant scent of freshly hewn poplar and cherry wood contrasted with the stink from the bubbling vats of glue and decomposing webs of animal skin at the far side of the archery workshop. Only 20 or so men of every 100 would carry archery equipment, but every soldier was expected to know how to maintain a bow and shoot one, and so the recruits were gathered around the academy's master archer, who sat hunched over his workbench, demonstrating how to fletch an arrow. While General Nuanza had the broad build of a bowman, he also had a gentle manner about him, a calm, methodical way of describing intricate detail.
And the feathers are applied in a specific pattern, Nuanza explained,
his dark, wiry eyebrows matching the shape of his sharply receding hairline.
It takes 3 feathers to fletch an arrow. 3 feathers, 3 gaps in between, he said, holding up 3 fingers to underline each statement. One of the gaps is bigger than the other 2, he said, deftly applying a touch of glue to a 3rd goose feather with a brush, then pressing it onto the end of the nearly complete arrow shaft, then holding the arrow up, end on, to the gathered recruits and pointing to the bigger gap.
The feather opposite this bigger gap is called the cock feather. Always this should be pointing away from the bow when you knock it to your string, to allow a clean shot.
He hooked a bow from the lower rack on the wall, tied the string around one horn-tipped end, then expertly looped that end over the front of an ankle and placed his other leg before the bow's midpoint and bent it round, bringing it under tension until the free ends of the bow and string met. Despite the great strength this required, his hands barely shook as he calmly tied the string into place. He lifted the bow, then broke off a chunk of yellow beeswax from the cake sitting on his workbench, and proceeded to wipe the wax up and down the bowstring in long, expert strokes.
Never let your bowstring dry out, he said,
taking up a patch of leather and rubbing the wax into the string.
And be sure to work the wax in well so the string absorbs it. The heat of your hand through the leather is enough for this.
Nuanza moved over to a rack on the wall behind the recruits, who turned like flowers following the sun. The archery master appraised each of the young men's height and shoulder width. He plucked out a bow from one of the high racks and gave it to Tanku, then gave a smaller lad one from the lower rack, and so on. Hattu took his, and the string Nuanza gave him, then stepped back and tried to repeat the stringing routine. What Nuanza had done effortlessly took Hattu 6 tries. Garin managed to bring the weapon under tension, only for it to slip from his grasp, one ear of the bow thwacking him in the genitals.
"Every man should have a bow that, when drawn back to the ear," Nuanza demonstrated, lifting the weapon and pulling back the string as if there were an arrow in place, "causes your hand to tremble just a little. And this means the horn and sinew in the bow are fully compressed and gives the perfect balance of power and accuracy. If your hand shakes too much, take a smaller bow. If you cannot draw back to your ear, take a larger one."
Along with the others, Hattu drew his bow back. It came all the way to his ear. Truth be told, it was an almighty struggle. He eyed the smaller bows in the rack and saw Dagon and Garin doing likewise. There was a tense moment where none of them wanted to be the first to take a weaker weapon. Nuanza strode forward and took up the smaller bows, giving one to each of the three.
"There is no shame in choosing the weapon that makes you a better archer," he said. "Remember, one day your life may depend upon it. And who would be impressed to look upon you struggling to pull a bow that is too powerful for you? Only your enemy, who will be laughing as he looses his own arrow for your heart."
Nuanza strode past them, beckoning them, his 3 tails of hair swishing between his powerful shoulders. They followed him outside into the afternoon sunshine. Hattu saw that a company of 20 veteran archers were lined up at the near end of the dusty archery field, their hair scooped back tightly like Nuanza's, so as not to blow in front of their bows.
"What are they shooting at?"
Dagon asked nobody in particular. Hattu scoured the undulating heat haze across the field. There was nothing but dust until the Red Fell slopes began a good 300 paces away.
"Oh, look,"
Tanku cooed, pointing. There at the far end of the field rested 4 cross-sections of tree trunk, daubed with dyes to make coloured rings. Hattu gasped.
"That's impossible."
Nuanza, hearing this, shot him a wry smile.
"Knock,"
he barked. The veteran 20 reached over their shoulders and plucked arrows from their quivers, affixing the grooved channel at one end to their bowstrings.
"Raise,"
Nuanza said. 20 bows rose up almost in unison, all canted to the same slight angle, all tilted to the same trajectory. Highly stressed horn and wood groaned as they each drew their strings back to their ears. Nuanza did this too, the veins in his forearm bulging under the immense tension of the bow.
"Loose!"
Nuanza howled. With a hiss, like a rising flock of birds, the arrows leapt forth. Then silence. Hattu frowned. It was as if they had melted into the heat haze. Only for a thick chorus of thok, thok, thok to herald missiles hitting timber. Hattu strained to see the targets again, and when the heat haze bent once more, he saw the arrows there, or maybe their shadows, quivering in the coloured rings. Instantly he wanted to dispense with sleep, food, water, and everything else, just to learn and harness the skills of these bowmen.
"How can you hit a target you can barely see?"
Hattu asked, directing the question at Garin. But it was Nuanza who answered.
"It is not what you see, it is what you know," he said, tapping a temple. "All men of the army are taught to shoot at a set of fixed distances. Then only one man need scout the enemy and call out the appropriate range. It means we can shoot over hills, in the black of night, or in the melting heat of day, and know we will strike our targets."
He turned to the 20 archers and bellowed,
"Short! Loose!"
With a flurry of knocking and bows rising, a lot less than before, 20 arrows hummed into the air and came thwacking down into the dust, almost in a line, around 100 paces away.
"Mid-range, loose!"
Thrum, thwack. Another perfect line, 200 paces away.
"You see,"
Nuanza said. For the rest of the afternoon, the archery master had them practice their draw, also showing them how to stretch their arms and shoulders before and after to avoid strain and cramp. For the last few hours of daylight, they emptied quiver after quiver into yellow targets, drawn up at short range. In truth, it took all of Hattu's strength to draw the bow enough to achieve this distance, and his accuracy suffered as a result, with every second arrow glancing off the edge of the target or plunging into the dust. He had grown strong in these last months, but not yet strong enough. He and the others shot on, almost entranced by the practice. Despite his limbs becoming fatigued, he found a rhythm, and soon each set of four or five arrows were thwacking into the timber target. They even took to betting against one another, though few wanted to gamble against the hawk-faced Kistner, who was skilled from the outset. When at last dusk claimed the remaining light, they were dismissed by Nuanza. Hattu had always been scared of the generals whenever they had appeared in the Acropolis grounds. Still, he considered Kurunta a living nightmare of sorts. But he realized he liked Nuanza, warm, encouraging, and approachable, a fine teacher. As they filed back from the archery school towards the infantry compound, he, Dagon, Tanku, and Garin joked and chatted with the others. It seemed they had accepted him at last. Hattu, as usual, glanced up at the scowling warrior statue standing over the barrack gates. For a change, he returned the stone effigy's glower with a wry one of his own, then laughed to himself. They returned to their barrack hut and combined rations to prepare a hearty stew of lamb boiled in yogurt and a few loaves of bread, eating it outside the porch area around a fire. The veterans from the neighbouring dorm offered them a barrel of barley beer, which they took gladly. And Raku, the flat-faced regimental chief, brought them a vase of strong wine, too. It seemed that it was not just the recruits who had thawed to the idea of having the cursed son in their midst. The warm meal filled Hattu's belly, and the frothy beer washed it down perfectly, warming his blood and softening his thoughts. Garin started a tale about home life and the woman who lived next door. All the recruits listened rapt as he began to describe her, drawing her figure in the air with his hands.
"And she has the most massive, and I mean massive—"
"What's this?"
a stern voice cut the story short. Hattu looked up to see Kurunta standing there. His face was fixed in its default state of apoplexy as he eyed the recruits and the fire. And he was a little gaunter than usual, probably thanks to his extended spell in the latrine pits.
"Sir," Garin saluted with a croak, "I was just telling my comrades about the woman that lives by our house in the temple ward."
He held out his hands again, squeezing invisible orbs, his face wide with a grin.
"You should see her ti—"
"Ah,"
Kurunta said, his good eye brightening.
"Yes, I know her. Kaya, isn't it?"
Garin's neck grew long.
"Yeah,"
he nodded in excitement. Kurunta's face fell expressionless.
"She's my niece."
With a whimper, Garin shrunk and stared intently at his feet. Hattu watched as Kurunta strode around the sitting circle of recruits. When the general passed behind Garin, he did something entirely unexpected. He winked at the others, flicked his head towards the shamed Garin, and mouthed,
"She's not really."
A few gasps and stifled laughs brought Garin's head up again, confused.
"Hey, what?"
But Kurunta threw down a small sack by the fire and crouched by it, his mien uplit by the flames.
"You can all talk about tits and asses again soon enough. First," he said, opening the sack, "you must make the comrade's oath. It signifies—"
He started, then sighed, a brief look of sadness crossing his lone eye.
"The end of infantry training."
The recruits all looked at one another, owl-eyed. He drew from the sack a handful of tallow, grey, white, and gelatinous, smearing a dab on the back of Garin's hand, then on Tanku's, then passing the sack around. Hattu followed suit, smearing the cold sheep fat on the back of his hand. Finally, the sack came round to Kurunta again. The general took another scoop of fat and tossed it on the fire. It hissed and sparked and quickly melted away to nothing.
"As the fat melts away into the dark earth, so also will he who breaks the trust of his brothers."
As he said this, The general passed his fat smeared hand across the fire, holding it at the highest point of the flames. The fat bubbled and spat, and the hair on his arm shriveled and vanished. Karunta was like a rock, unflinching, until the molten fat had liquefied and rolled off his hand into the flames. He looked up darkly.
Next.
Garin, on the end of Karunta's glare, slumped, then steadied himself, meeting the eyes of each of the recruits. He passed his shaking hand through the inferno, stiffening, his face aghast at first. But Hattu saw a change in him, and knew the hand would remain.
Comrades, I will never abandon you,
he said as the fat dripped away. As Garin furtively nursed his hand, Dagon went next.
Keen, friends,
he looked up, catching Hattu's eye.
I owe each of you my life. Comrades, until I breathe my last.
A low rumble of anxious, excited agreement broke out amongst the others. Tanku was next.
I will honour you as I honour the gods always,
he said, the flames licking at his thick arms.
We are one spear.
Sargis, Kistner, and a handful of others took their turn. Next, Karunta's good eyes swiveled round to Hattu, narrowing to a crescent. It was time. Hattu held his gaze as he passed his hand into the fire. The breath caught in his lungs as the flames licked around his flesh. The pain was instant and intense, but he knew it would take a team of 6 Lucan horses to drag his hand away.
All my life I have been alone, he said. Now I am a soldier. A soldier with 99 brothers. I will give my life for the Mountain Wolves.
The circle exploded into a cacophony of cheering. Tanku and Dagon threw their heads back and howled, the others joining in. Hattu kept his eyes on Karunta. The gnarled general made a single grunting noise, then rose from his haunches. Maybe, just maybe, there was a glint of respect in the haggard demon's lone eye. As the summer came to an end, the land cooled and the trees turned russet and gold, and the fields of bronze grew busy with men preparing for winter billet. The standing troops stationed here over summer were dispersed to their homes or to workshops in the cities, leaving just a skeleton garrison of a few hundred to look after the snowbound academy over winter. Soldiers paced from place to place, towing carts of arms and supplies. Many eyed the Arzana house enviously, hearing the pipe music and the laughter of the off-duty men emanating from within. Those who passed the command building near the paddocks cast spellbound looks at the royal carriage drawn up there, watched over by 2 glittering Mercedes. Inside the cool, shady command building, King Masili sat across a table from Karunta. The Mountain Wolves, the king repeated, as if he had misheard. Karunta nodded reluctantly.
I named them the Hill Pups. They decided to change it.
Masili sat back on his chair, cradling his chin between thumb and forefinger.
And it was my boy who named them.
Karunta shrugged.
Aye, he did. The rest of the 100 agreed readily to his suggestion. And then they sat together, painting blood-red streaks on their shields and on their skin. Like the tear of a wolf's claws, Karunta said, with a weary flick of his eyebrows.
They hold him in some esteem, then? Masili asked.
When I sent Hattu to you, I ordered you to— He will not break,
Karunta interrupted.
Forgive me, my son, he reprimanded himself. But I have put him through the grimmest trials. First it was the water ordeal, carrying to the hills a burden that no soldier could manage.
He snorted in incredulity.
I even told him Prince Muwa had beaten the challenge, and I have only ever subjected troublemakers to it.
He leaned forward to hold Masili's attention.
The point of the task is that it is impossible. It is designed to break the spirit and the body, yet he found a way. He broke the damn challenge.
He shook his head.
There was one night, before he managed it, when I could tell he was wavering, thinking of leaving. I opened the gates to the infantry compound before I turned in, thinking he would be gone in the morning. But he did not leave. The sentries told me he'd risen and taken to scramble him up the hills in the darkness. For over a month I left the gates unlocked. He had ample chance to leave and refused it.
I've known you a long time, Masili said. You have many tricks to break a man.
Karunta shrugged.
Indeed. Next, I took him to the bridge of the mountain god.
The jump, Masili said, leaning forward in interest. Karunta avoided the king's eyes.
I wrapped cloth around his eyes and...
Masili drew in a tight breath.
You made him jump blindfolded. When I asked you to break my son, I did not mean physically. Absolve me, my son. I did not expect him to actually attempt the jump, but he did. And he made it with room to spare. Then I subjected them all to the river ordeal, up in the ice stream.
Karunta's face crumpled.
And I will admit I maybe only did that because I was angry, and a bit hungry, and I had a sore tooth. But I watched them, and I saw that it was Hattu who worked it out, the key to minimizing the pain of the ordeal. Next, he saved one of his comrades, probably his biggest detractor, who had fallen into the ravine.
He threw up his hands in exasperation.
After that, I took them on a full morning's run around the hottest valleys in the fells. I noticed Hattu falling back. I thought I'd cracked it then, until I saw that he had merely slowed to help the lad at the rear, Garin, built like a date pudding.
Yet he has not excelled, has he? Masili mused. You say it was the big one, named Tanku, who they elected as their captain?
Karunta chapped the table in frustration.
Half elected Tanku, half Hattu. Hattu convinced them Tanku was the better choice, stronger, louder, and fiercer.
And then his meekness remains?
Karunta flashed a dry, foul grin.
Not meek. Bright. Selfless. Tanku selected Hattu as his chosen man. It was the moment I knew that the boy's place is in the army. Raku Flatface, the chief of the Storm's first regiment, did not want him in his thousand at first. Now he does. Hattu is the finest prospect I have trained in some time. Bright of mind and fleet of foot. He is stronger even than Prince Muwa was at that age.
Masili felt Ishtar's invisible finger trace his spine.
Aye. Well, he will serve as a fine assistant when Muwa becomes king, he said, more tersely than intended.
Karunta searched the king's face, confused, then relaxed.
There is not a hint of treachery in him, my son. Let Ishtar forgive me for this, but what she told you that night is not true. He will not seek to harm you or his brother. I can assure you of that much.
Can you?
Masili replied instantly.
You have known me your entire life. You know that I don't fawn to you like others. I can only give you my honest opinion.
Karunta sighed.
But that aside, you asked me to break him. I'm sorry, my son, for on that front I have failed you.
Masili's eyes drifted across the scars on the table.
Alas, I fear you could never have succeeded. Fate, it seems, is a river that no man can divert.
What for Hattu now?
Karunta asked.
Will you take him with you back to Hattusa? I've overheard him talking with the others. He has spoken with some fondness of returning to the Acropolis over winter.
Masili's eyes brightened.
Well, he yearns for a soft bed.
No, he merely longs to show you how well he has done,
Karunta replied.
He itches to make you proud, my son.
Masili tapped his lips with his forefinger a few times, caught in some inner dilemma.
He is to stay here over the snows, he said at last, with the winter guard.
Karunta's eyes fell.
I will tell him so, he said sadly.
His training is not complete, Masili grumbled. He may think he has beaten the rigors of the academy, but he has yet to be put through his paces by Coulter.
Karunta's gaze lifted to meet the king's again.
True. Many infantrymen, nobles, some princes even, have been reduced to white-faced wrecks by the old Hercler and his damned horses.
His good eye glazed for a moment, and he issued a short, reminiscent laugh. Masili drummed his fingers on the table.
Then that is how it shall be. Hattu will stay here through the winter and next summer too. And it will be me
he will stand before at the end. The chariot ordeal separates the strong from the mighty. It will be me who grants him or denies him the status he covets, he snapped, as a true prince.
A streak of hot, stinging pain shot down his left arm as he heard his own words ringing around the room. He clasped a hand to his armpit, feeling pins and needles in his left hand.
My son,
Kurunta gasped, half rising from his seat. Mersili waved him back testily. Recapturing his breath, he dipped his head.
Watch over my son. That he grows strong and skilled should fill me with pride and hope. Yet still, all I can see when I look at him is what I gave up so he could live. And all I can hear when he speaks is Ishtar's pledge of the dark future. Hattu is a good lad, my son,
Kurunta said earnestly. Masili's bloodshot eyes flicked up, alight, his face somber.
No man is born wicked, old friend.
Hattu sat by the window of the Arzana house, oblivious to the skirling, pacey pipes and the raucous goings on around him. His eyes were trained on the command house across the track, still and silent in the twilight, the ruts of King Mersili's recently departed carriage still fresh in the dust.
I understand now, father. You wanted me to fail, to return to my old life and remain there,
Hattu mused. He felt no anger, just a heavy sense of betrayal. In his short visit to the academy, the king had not even sought him out. Instead, Goru, the Mercedi, had come into the Arzana house to tell him that he was to remain at the Fields of Bronze throughout the winter.
Why? Because you think I will finally break and cry for my soft bed in the palace? Or to keep me safely distant from Hattusa and the Grey Throne? The chair you think I am destined to seize for myself? You do not trust me.